Good morning. A handful of affordable and public housing bills will be heard today. Longtime advocate Victor Gemignani of the Hawaii Appleseed Law Center reviews them. Meanwhile, could the new soil study at Sand Island mean a reactivation of the plan for a temporary homeless shelter? A leader of the movement to protect the homeless is already countering that idea. Kathy Jean joins us.
And was the Second World War brought about by the peace treaty that followed the first? I'm Chris Vandercook. Some historians wonder if the Paris Peace Conference could have prevented many of the struggles that followed. Students at St. Francis School are being invited to reenact and rewrite a pivotal moment in history. And Dr. Celia Smith of the UH Botany Department tells us why the next Waikiki Aquarium invasive algae cleanup is so important.
It's Monday, March 16th. The conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. You're listening to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
Well, I think we're all trying to get on the mend, as many people have been dealing with the same bug that's been floating around HPR
these
days.
Indeed. I was a little surprised by the report on the soil at Sand Island.
From Friday, when we were talking about that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see if that's going to have any implications with what may happen with Sand Island as a homeless encampment. You know that last week the Hawaii Department of Health released that report on the soil samples taken from Sand Island, and unlike past studies, the results this time around seem to allay the concerns over contamination. That would appear to be a game changer for last year's plan from Honolulu Mayor Kurt Caldwell to stage a temporary homeless shelter at Sand Island. Even with the new test findings, homeless advocate Catherine Jean is making a preemptive strike at that idea. She's with us this morning to explain why. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
When we first talked about this idea last summer, there were many folks who were in opposition to it, saying that this is not a place that would be appropriate to put people who are homeless, families who are homeless, and that's the issue with soil contamination came up, and it seemed to shut down that idea. Now, as of last week, Department of Health saying, well, maybe the soil isn't contaminated after all. That doesn't seem to stop the first part of the argument that it's not an appropriate place from your perspective.
Right. The issue of toxicity was really part of a overall comprehensive critique of the ineffectiveness and inappropriateness of this proposal regarding safety. The toxicity is one factor of the safety issue that we brought to the BLNR. The vast majority of the safety issues had to do with how this facility was constructed, what would be available as far as water and resources, if it was safe due to its proximity, being isolated away from the general population, away from schools, away from stores to get food, that kind of thing. So really, regardless of whether or not Sand Island is toxified, the issues relating to the safety and the welfare of the possible families with children, as well as the chronically homeless placed out there, outweighs any sort of question of whether to put them out there.
And then there's that other issue of whether or not the first Housing First dollar should be used for that.
Yeah, we really think that Housing First dollars should be just kept to Housing First, because a temporary homeless encampment flies in the face of best practices for Housing First. By definition, Housing First is immediate permanent housing and wraparound services in a nutshell. Having them placed for 2 to 3 years in a temporary homeless encampment is not that, and it would be a waste of taxpayer dollars.
Have you had any indication from the city that they are, in fact, looking at this idea more seriously now that we've had this toxicity report come out?
Well, the city has not averred any stance on whether or not they're going to go forward with this, but they do need to have somewhere to place houseless people now that CITLA is being enforced and all of these bans and laws that are criminalizing the houseless living in public spaces. What we see on the ground level is a massive increase of houseless persons living in public spaces. They're not being coerced into shelters because of various very valid reasons. Shelters oftentimes are discriminatory. They're not safe, simply don't have any space to fit the entire unsheltered population. So the question becomes, if they're not moving into shelter, where are you going to put them? I think the general public is seeing this day to day, with more houseless people being visible in the places where they live, in residential areas and places where they shop. It's really hasn't been affecting in a positive way the issue of houselessness in a progressive, productive avenue that eventually results in permanent housing. And so what do? We try to figure out places to put them that aren't really well thought out, like Sand Island or other temporary houseless encampments, which in the past have proven to be ineffective.
We also are told that the shelters on Oahu are not filled and that that's part of the problem.
Right. I believe Focus came out with some pretty telling data, longitudinal data, that suggests that, you know, these laws aren't being effective in what they say that they were supposed to do, which was
get people into shelter,
right? And so that underscores a very important fact that there is a really good reason why massive numbers of houseless people are not going or getting into shelters, and that needs to be taken a look at.
Specifically, what do they tell you when, you know, you can say, but here's a place for you to go, and from the outside it may look like that's a very viable option, but to someone who is looking at being the person going into that shelter who says, no, I'm not going to go, why do they say that?
For good reasons. The main one is that they can't get in. And the reason why they can't get in is sometimes many times the shelters are full. Most other times is that they need ID as a requirement to get into shelters or stay for a prolonged period of time in the shelter. And what's happening out there is that these houseless encampments are being swept, or what they call enforcements on the poor, where in which all of their belongings are taken from them. And with those belongings include social security cards, state IDs, driver's license, birth certificates, all of the things that you need to gain employment, to get shelter, to get any sort of benefits, and to get even into housing first. Now, once those IDs are taken, you know, you have a policy that's being implemented on a weekly basis almost island-wide that is actually preventing people from maintaining or entering into shelter. Other reasons include staff that are discriminatory towards or abusive towards residents. Now, this isn't categorical, okay? So there are certain staff that are great at what they do in shelters, and then there are other staff that are not.
And do you know this, I mean, firsthand this is sounding a bit like hearsay.
Well, absolutely. This we wouldn't be saying this publicly unless there are dozens and dozens of people that we have been interviewing and surveying that are saying this about shelters, which is why they're not going.
And are they naming those shelters where they won't go?
Yes. So oftentimes they can't get into Next Step because Next Step is usually full, and they have to check on a daily basis, and they just give up. A lot of comments that are negative are directed to IHS, and I kind of understand why all of those comments against IHS are all negative, because IHS has allied with the mayor and the city council in this criminalization campaign against the poor, promoting Sit Lai, making statements publicly that Sit Lai works for their best advantage, and it doesn't work towards anyone's advantage. Laws like Sit Lai and the laws that permit the city to engage in sweeps on homeless encampments are basically and thoroughly inhumane. It is absolutely horrendous to witness and to try to give services to a family, a homeless family, who has lost everything at threat of arrest because of these laws.
As you say, that getting into a shelter may mean that you have to have proof of ID, which if it's been swept, you don't have, and other reasons that there might be vacancies. But given the vast number of people who we see who are still homeless, I mean, it's not a huge number maybe compared to other cities, but the very visible homeless that we see, that there's no one really you think that can be placed into shelters, so that the argument could be made, well, the shelters really are full up? I mean, are there not enough people coming behind those who maybe can't get in, but there's still some who can?
Right. Mm-hmm. And the ones who can are confronted with prohibitive steps in which to enter into shelter. Like, they need to prove that they've been homeless for a certain amount of time. They need other agencies to write them a letter. That takes more time. They need ID eventually to do a background check if they get in. They also need to pay a monthly fee, which sometimes can be very considerable, especially if you're houseless and you don't have ID and you can't get work, or you lose your job because of a raid. How are you then able to pay for the monthly fee? For people who have residency in Hawaii, that fee is $90 per person per month. If you can't prove that you've been in Hawaii for at least 30 days, that number jumps to $400 a month.
So at this point, given the fact that there's no discussion whether or not Sand Island may be revivified as an idea, you're still looking at the same thing that we've been seeing for quite a while now. What's the next step in your mind now?
I believe that funding needs to be pumped into the Housing First program, because Housing First works. We believe that the state has a really good grasp. I reiterate that. The state has a really good grasp of a true Housing First program. Funds need to be allocated en masse to address the rising number of homeless. The largest, fastest growing population is houseless families with children. On top of that, we need to expand the scope of Housing First to not just address chronically homeless persons, but also families with children and seniors as well.
And that goes back to the whole issue of affordable housing and public housing. And we're going to talk about that a little later on today with Victor Gemignani from Hawaii Appleseed. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Catherine John is the executive director and co-founder of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported HBR2. It's now 8:15. Coming up, rewriting 20th century history as a high school project. But first, your backyard quiz.
A little later in today's show, I'll talk with Dr. Celia Smith of the Botany Department about invasive algae, and that leads us to the subject of today's backyard quiz. We're thinking about one of the species of algae that caused the most trouble in Hawaiian waters. Described on the Department of Land and Natural Resources Aquatic Invasive Species webpage as thick, warty, plastic-like, irregularly branching algae that grows in tumbleweed-like clumps. It can be yellow, green, or brown in color, grows on reef flats or on a sand bed. It grows very fast, often doubling its size in 15 to 30 days. It was imported to Hawaii from the Philippines for commercial purposes. One use was keeping ice chunks from forming in ice cream. That may have seemed like a good idea at the time, but the effect of capificus, to call it by its Latin name, has been destructive to coral reef ecosystems. We're looking for the common English name of this visitor that has long since worn out its welcome, and we'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first right answer gets the T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Michael Morehouse from the Kahala Hotel. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Could the 20th century have turned out very differently? 20 years after the Treaty of Versailles that set terms for victors and vanquished, after the First World War tore Europe apart, those same countries were at it again. What happened? This was supposed to be the war to end all wars. The treaty the victors wrote in 1919 was driven by a determination to bring about world peace. So where did they go wrong? Carlisle Cameron is inviting her students at St. Francis School to rewrite history. She's on hand to tell us about it. Good morning, Carlisle. How are you?
Good morning.
We can only imagine the difficulty of the decisions that were faced by the diplomats who wrote the Paris peace talks.
Yes.
But still, what's the sort of overview of what happened, what resulted from that?
Well, part of what started this entire thing was giving students a chance to see how history overlaps itself. Mm-hmm. And the idea actually came up when I was watching Prime Minister Netanyahu's recent address, mm-hmm. and he was talking about Iran's nuclear age. And I started backing up, and I knew we were starting World War One. And it almost becomes, well, if this happened, if this didn't happen, then this wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And so I started looking at how to truly understand World War II. And in order to understand World War II, you have to go back to World War I. And the pivotal point becomes the Treaty of Versailles. And what if students could completely change history? So we put together a game where the groups were actually divided into three: France, Britain, and the United States. Mm-hmm. And they were given certain points that they had to familiarize themselves with, understanding that at a certain point, which would be today, they would negotiate with the other two countries. So what it allows them to do is not only look at some of the points, but also to understand, and we talked about this in class, if the Treaty of Versailles had been different, could there have been someone like Hitler coming to power? And if there's no Hitler, would there have been a Holocaust? Would there have been a World War II? Would there have been an atomic bomb? So would there have been a nuclear age? And if there wasn't, would Prime Minister Netanyahu be addressing
Absolutely,
exactly.
Interconnected, because yeah. Also the current map of the Middle East is very much determined by
exactly.
the Treaty of Versailles. And very arbitrary in terms of the people who actually live
exactly,
in the Middle East.
Exactly, yes. So it allows them to really explore in their research what they need, and to also indirectly see some of the challenges faced in foreign policy when they try to negotiate with each other, because each country is going to sit at the table with a different agenda.
Yeah.
They receive points or lose points based on their ability to meet their agenda. And that's the first part of the game.
And allies can have competing agendas,
exactly.
even allies in victory.
So it's important to also simplify it for them, where if they can understand the nuances of a friendship and loyalty and conflict and what you will do for a friend, if you can understand that, then you can actually, on a simpler basis, understand what happens in foreign policy in terms of allies. And so we also looked at certain things that were of an issue over the last week. We talked about different territories that are going to be a part of the discussion of whether or not they should be returned to their original country. Why did they become a part of German territory? And then also, in trying to understand the war reparations and the war guilt clause, to really kind of take a look at how much is enough. So each country...
Do you need to destroy a country's economy?
Exactly. And what was everybody's mission in this? So France, the students in France have a completely different outlook than, say, the United States. Just
sure.
because the majority of the war was fought on their territory.
And they're not likely to be, the United
exactly.
States is not likely
yeah.
to be invaded
exactly.
the next time.
So talking individually with each country allowed them to see what they needed to really consider. And then I asked them, how much is it going to cost to repair your nation after this war? And if somebody else doesn't pay for it, can your country afford to pay for it?
Yeah.
What are your citizens going to think if you come back without enough money to rebuild your villages? So it really becomes something that is student driven, and in the process it gains momentum and they become more and more competitive about winning the most points. And they did something very similar in the first semester, which was a constitutional convention, where they got very competitive. They really got caught up in the energy of winning,
mm-hmm.
only to discover that unless you work together, there are no winners.
Which is kind of a replay of, of America's Constitutional Convention.
Yeah.
Well, again and again, what you're showing them is that things are a lot more complex than you would have thought, rather than the opposite. This is not simplifying history.
No.
It's, you can't give something without giving something back.
Exactly.
The whole give and take of diplomacy and the terrible compromises that that leaders of nations have to face. What if people die as a result of the decisions you just made?
It's true, and I think they did learn some lessons from the previous simulation that we did, and they're applying them to this one. And to understand how to sit at a table with your agenda and try to understand the others, at a certain point in the game, it initially starts off kind of like a poker game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how I explained it to them. Do you want to show your cards?
Right.
But at a certain point when the game switches and they are no longer going to be gaining points, and they're going to be allowed to, I hope they're not listening because they're not supposed to know this, but at a certain point halfway in the game switches, and instead of gaining points, it becomes, what's the best treaty that you can do, and how they will switch, how they deal with each other and really start to cooperate with each other so that we can, after it's all done, sit down and say, you know, what's the difference? How can we get to that point? And now you can sort of understand the difficulties that people that are in foreign policy have to deal with because they are instructed to deal with their country's agenda.
And you know, it's also part of becoming an adult, it facing compromise. You know, young people find it very easy to deride the compromises adults make until they grow up a little bit.
There are so many life lessons in this, so it's
terrific.
I think it's
project.
Really helpful.
Thanks very much, Carlisle. Carlisle Cameron has been a history teacher at St. Francis School for six of her 16 years as an educator, and you can learn more about her Paris Peace Talks project on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Press that tear up from your eyes, soldier boy. When you're on the deep blue sea, when you sometimes think of me, I'll be waiting anxiously, soldier boy. So we're many friends, a friend, a soldier boy. Keep my picture near your heart, soldier boy. When you've won your victory, God will bring you back to me.
The response of Hawaii Public Radio supporters to the early bird rally has been tremendous. A record number of station members have endorsed the idea of spending fewer days on air by making early gifts to Challenge 2015. We gratefully acknowledge Rita Okin of Haiku, Flora Obayashi of Kaneohe, and Geraldine Davis of Pearl City. Thank you all for your generous support. Now, if this pace continues, perhaps there might not be the need for an on-air campaign at all. It's your call. Find our donation form at hawaiipublicradio.org. Now, moving on, U.S. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard's rise to fame continues to keep her in the spotlight and draw scrutiny. At issue right now is her silence about her family's connection to a Hawaii Krishna cult. Civil Beat did some digging, and reporter Chad Blair has this reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So, you know, this stuff has been swirling around her for quite a while, and the question sort of is, does it make any difference in what you found in terms of her ability to do her job or any particular agenda? Was there any evidence to some of the rumors that have been swirling around her?
No, in terms of Tulsi Gabbard being a congresswoman representing Hawaii, I don't know that there's been really any impact from these rumors, these stories that have circulated. We're talking about Chris Butler, the Hawaii resident at one time that was affiliated with some folks like Mike Gabbard and Carol Gabbard, Tulsi's parents. And indeed, there are some close associates of the congresswoman that do have ties. family ties back to Chris Butler. They include her fiancé, the person she's marrying next week, and also her new chief of staff. But in terms of a secret agenda or somehow that this is swaying how she behaves in Congress, in Washington, D.C., no, I don't know that we uncovered anything like that at all.
So what puts all of this still, you know, running through the rumor mill if there doesn't seem to be anything consequential that a lot of people can point to?
Oh, I think what was important is to actually look and see if there really was something that people are pointing to as being consequential. Even now, with these two stories out up on our site this morning, those same discussions are continuing. And it's because Tulsi Gabbard has such a rising profile nationally. I mean, after all, she's frequently on CNN and Fox News and quoted in the New York Times. She has become a national figure, particularly on foreign policy matters. And that, of course, lends itself to more scrutiny, not only from people who follow her, people who oppose her, but also the media, whose job is to take a look at this stuff and keep people accountable.
She's been rather silent about any connection to any of that, saying, you know, that's personal business. Even when you asked her directly, of the response that you got, which you've published on your site, goes to a completely different issue.
That's correct. She would not actually consent to being interviewed by Louis Kinnea, the reporter for Civil Beat, who did the main piece. Instead, she sent us a written statement talking about her religion and how proud she is to be a Hindu in the Congress. She did not respond at all to the rumors around Chris Butler, the cult, and so forth. That is her preferred way with us. She does not like to sit down with an interview and have a discussion.
So very, very, very briefly, what do you take away from this?
Well, I guess what I take away was I'm glad that we looked at this information and found out what we could and also dispelled other things. And I think that's, frankly, a public service because this stuff has been around much longer than Tulsi's been around. It really dates back to the 1970s. And I think it was important to actually see what is out there. Perhaps more information will be forthcoming, but I feel pretty good that we've contributed to the public record of trying to understand who Tulsi Gabbard is and what forms her surroundings.
And time that it got done with everything that's been around for such a very long time. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com. Each year we hear an indisputable fact. Hawaii's inventory of affordable and public housing units continue to be outpaced by need. According to an often cited 2011 housing planning study, up to 50,000 new housing units will have to be built by 2016, and existing public housing has an almost $800 million backlog of repairs. Up for hearing today are a half dozen bills focused on affordable and public housing creation and repair. Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice Executive Director Victor Gemignani has reviewed them, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just seeing the volume of these bills that are continuing to move and the fact that they may have some redundancies, but clearly a focus on bringing up more units, being able to refurbish some of the ones that are there, does this feel like it's a big win after all this time of talking about this?
Well, we'll declare a win when there's actually figures on the table that we can take a look at, and we know what impact it's going to happen within the housing development market. But yes, definitely, we think that there has been a corner that has been turned, and that because of the pent-up demand, which is so extreme in our state, new models are being introduced that are gathering more and more popular support, units like accessory dwelling units and micro units, and obviously the continuation and expansion of the Housing First program for the homeless.
Let's talk about some of that pent-up demand and also what that means in the context of today's market. There was a study that you cited that says that, you know, cost for a rent of a two-bedroom unit requires a salary of over $32 an hour. You broke down hourly so you could be able to make a cost comparison, and that the median salary of a renter is about $13, maybe between $13 and $14, clearly not able to afford rent for a two-bedroom place.
That's correct.
Where does that leave them?
According to the it leaves them pinched and potentially on the street. The problem with the low and moderate income population is if they are a paycheck or two away from the streets because of the lack of availability of affordable housing, anything happens in their life that's a crisis, disabilities, a family, domestic violence issues, a split in the family, anything could happen to ultimately send people down into a spiral. We have, as we know in the state, the highest rate of homelessness among all states. We have about 14,000 people at any one particular time or during any particular year that are experiencing homelessness. 40% of those are kids. The market has dramatically increased in terms of the cost. HUD, recent estimate of the fair market value for a two-bedroom apartment is about $1,800. As you said, that's increased, by the way, by 90% since 2005. In the last 10 years, we've had a 90% increase in the cost of two-bedroom apartments. And that, of course, filters down to smaller units, one-bedroom and studios.
And meanwhile, in the last 10 years, we've only built a little under 5,000 affordable units.
It's only because of the Rental Housing Trust Fund that we've been able to build about 4,500 units. Without that, there have been virtually no low-income rental housing built. There have been some affordable housing built for owners, owner occupancy purchases, but not for renters. Very little renting housing has been developed, and that's one of the reasons we have the crisis. According to the, you mentioning the state plan on housing, the 2011 state plan indicated we needed about 18,000 units for those that are living under 80% of AMI and below in terms of salaries, and that's in the neighborhood of $60,000 for one person.
And AMI, although that's in your lingo, for most people that would be
area median income.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, area median income. So the bottom line is we have the new study that's just been produced by HHFDC indicates that we are falling even farther behind. We need now 27,000 units by 2012, not 18,000 units. Most distressing for us, those that are living at 60% of AMI, again, area median income, which is about $45,000 for one individual. The need for housing has doubled. It's now closer to $20,000, 20,000 units as opposed to the 13,000 that was estimated in 2011. So we are falling farther and farther and farther behind in terms of the ability to house our residents.
As that gap has continued to widen, obviously more attention has been placed on the trust fund. You say there's not a figure placed into the bills yet. What would have to be put into that bill to be able to make some sort of gain on that huge disparity?
Well, we are very happy that the governor has recommended that the legislature appropriate $100 million. That would create about 600 units. Could also create in the process about 700 jobs because of the construction that has to be done for those units. The legislature now is considering appropriations. They haven't decided exactly how much will be appropriated. We're again hoping for $100 million. That would make a significant increase in the amount of housing and start a trend that I think is going to ultimately be necessary to overcome the problems we have.
Where specifically would these units best be placed?
Well, for the most part, because of the rail that has been in the process of being built and debated, I might add, continually over the last 4, 5, 6 years, transit-oriented development has become the primary vehicle for creating affordable rental housing for our residents. So all along the rail line, at each of the stops, you will have developments being built, and there's a series of models that are being used and tested right now, hopefully tested, depending upon what happens with appropriations on some of these bills in the legislature, around the creation of micro units, smaller units. And we're trying to introduce into Hawaii the concept of smaller units for people to live in.
And when you say small, let's talk about how small.
Yeah. The bills, when they provide a definition, there are two bills that are pending in terms of appropriations, one in the House and one in the Senate for micro units. They define a micro unit as a unit between 280 square feet and 320 square feet for one or two people. For every additional person that's going to occupy the unit, it would be an additional 100 square feet. So a family of three would have somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 square feet, a family of four, about 500 square feet. Again, these are built on concepts that have been developed in the mainland in a number of cities in areas where there is a high demand for housing and a high cost of living and therefore a limited supply available. Interesting figure, by the way, in the state of Hawaii, about 25% of all renters, and another figure, 43% of our residents are renters. So we have a large number of renters in our state. And 30% of those renters on Oahu are single households. It's 25% statewide. We have a heavier concentration of single renters in Oahu. So the concept of micro units that are well designed and efficient and effective, cost about half of what a regular unit would cost, really are some of the components of an answer to how we get out of this hole that we've dug for ourselves in terms of affordability.
And also the necessity for them to be around transit, because presumably with the parking density that would be necessary if all these people were to have cars, that wouldn't be practicable. And the reality is most of these people don't have cars anyway.
Exactly. One of the costs of the development of housing is the infrastructure that's necessary, and zoning requires parking for units that are built. And if you could waive the need for parking because it's around transit-oriented development and most of these people are not going to have cars anyway, it significantly increases the efficiency of micro units.
Before we let you go, just for a second, I know you're not going to call it a big win until you actually see this move through and it's after the session is finished. But at this point, are you feeling pretty good that this is the year where we're going to make some headway? We've been talking about this for such a long time. And as you say, that gap is getting wider and wider.
I said this about a year ago. I think we've turned the corner. When the community finally started to acknowledge the depth of our problem in housing our own people, and models started to be discussed as a changing way of how we're going to house our people. I was very optimistic. I'm even more optimistic now since we have three bills in the legislature that deal specifically with the types of models that we've been suggesting for a number of years. So I really do think because of the pent-up demand, because of the acknowledgement that the demand is really at a crisis stage, that the legislature and the governor and the city are now on the same page.
All right. We'll wait to see whether all that comes to be true or not, so you can call it an official win. Hopefully by the time we finish in May, we'll see where we go with it. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Victor Geminiani is the Executive Director of Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. The center advocates on behalf of low-income people in Hawaii to help them gain access to resources, services, and fair treatment.
It's time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in our island skies and also what's happening in the world of astronomy. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, Venus and Mars continue their descent into the western horizon. Mars will set at 8 p.m., followed by Venus around about 8:40 p.m. Jupiter will also be visible in the eastern sky as soon as the sun sets, while Saturn will rise around 11 p.m. Now, our moon this week is moving into its new moon phase. And as the week goes on, we can expect our skies to be dark and star-filled.
Now, one of the planets that Christopher mentioned, we have not had a feature on in a little while, and we actually have some news about a return to Jupiter.
That's right. This week, we have wet Jovian moons. The Hubble Space Telescope has been used to detect evidence of an ocean on Jupiter's moon, Ganymede. Ganymede is larger than our own moon, but not quite as big as the Earth. The ocean lying beneath the icy crust of Ganymede is thought to contain more water than all of Earth's oceans combined.
That's a lot of water.
It sure is.
And so how deep is the ocean there?
Well, we think the ocean on Ganymede is around 60 miles deep. That's around 10 times deeper than the oceans on the Earth. It's also thought to be salty, which is a good sign for any potential life that might exist there.
So how does the Hubble factor into this? I thought that was like a distant galaxy search, not so much about water.
Well, Hubble is famous for its observations of distant galaxies, nebula, all that sort of thing. But it also conducts observations close to home. The Hubble team were able to observe movements in the auroras on Ganymede. This movement led researchers to conclude that beneath the surface of Ganymede, there must be considerable amounts of water.
What makes the aurora an indicator?
Well, auroras occur when a planet or moon has a magnetic field, just like the Earth. Changes in the magnetic field can be used to detect water.
And this is real salty water, huh?
We think so.
So is this tool going to be valuable in finding water in more distant places?
It sure is. It is totally possible that we could use this technique to find water on distant alien worlds. In fact, scientists will use the data collected by Hubble this time round to assist them when looking at distant planets in the future. Right now, though, the solar system is where it's at. Who knows what we will find in the oceans of the moons of Jupiter?
Better bring our fishing poles.
And your sea monkeys.
Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, thank you for this report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next time for Stargazer.
And now from the skies to the sea, Before, Chris talks with Dr. Celia Smith about the invasive algae cleanup at the Waikiki Aquarium. Let's go get an answer for the backyard quiz. Now, today we considered an invasive species that was brought to Hawaii with the best of intentions, only to end up destroying fragile reef ecosystems. This one, known by the Latin name Capificus, grows at an incredibly fast rate, doubling its size in 15 to 30 days. When it does, it deprives coral of sunlight, killing the reef and the marine life around it. It's especially prevalent in Kaneohe Bay, and for a while the state was using a gigantic underwater vacuum cleaner called the Super Sucker to get rid of it there. That proved to be an expensive measure. Scientists are now placing their hopes on a native sea urchin that has been introduced to the bay to devour the algae. We asked you for the name of this pest, and it's an appropriate one, smothering seaweed. It's 8:48. That's the answer to today's quiz, which no one was able to provide for us, so the T-shirt will have to go to tomorrow. But if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
So many plant and animal species have been introduced to Hawaii, either by accident or design. Some are brought here with good intentions and disastrous results. Hawaii's reef ecosystems, a source of so much life, face a particular danger from invasive algae. Dr. Celia Smith of the UH Mau Manoa Botany Department has made Hawaii's invasives her specialty. She's part of the Waikiki Aquarium's invasive algae cleanup this weekend, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Celia.
Aloha, Chris. Aloha, Bethan.
How did this mess get started in the first place? By mess, I mean algae essentially covering the coral, killing the reef, right?
Right. In an earlier era, as was noted in the previous conversation, the efforts were to really bring in plants that might have an economic benefit to the state or provide income and job security for other peoples. Mm-hmm. But in order to really understand the impact, we have to start at understanding what a healthy reef has. And so a healthy reef is a place where we have bottom-up feeding of all the herbivores in an area. Basically everything, or almost everything, that moves is eating algae. And mm-hmm. in that case, about 2,000 bites per meter square per day is the kind of herbivory pressure for a healthy reef. Mm-hmm. What these invasives do is come into, by human impact, are introduced to a reef, but they're not the kind that most of those herbivores would eat.
So and they just grow
they
and grow.
They just grow. And the best image I can recall is what my front yard looks like after baseball playing the whole season where the weeds are quite deep. Mm-hmm. And that's what effectively we have when no one is tending the garden of those reefs because there aren't enough herbivores in some cases, or the herbivores are not eating what's there because of these invasives are generally not too tasty. Many of the urchins or reef fish would prefer to eat other, at least of the ones that we have on our reefs now.
And being not too tasty works to their advantage because they just thrive and thrive.
They just thrive. It's as if they are growing in a nutrient culture without any kind of limitation. And that's the cost that our native species have paid. We've lost, in Waikiki in particular, 85 native macroalgae. And so some of those are the species that the Hawaiian culture would really love to have, like limukala for mm-hmm. ho'oponopono or limukohu to mix in with your poi. We have the loss of that kind of aesthetic value, the value that these reefs play to our host, to our culture. Mm-hmm. We've also, when there are a few fish in an area, we lose food security. We've not got that refrigerator stocked with all the species that we would want for dinner. And that's particularly important when we have disasters that hit and the inability to provide food on the basis that we actually need for these islands, we fish. And in that case, if there aren't fish in our refrigerator, we're in real trouble.
It's that whole ironic move away, historic move away from self-reliance that we've had in the islands,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Our reefs, healthy reefs, provide us resilience against storm damage, wave force action. And so we face real challenges. The healthy reef protects our future, and these reefs with invasive algae are not healthy. Our future is at risk.
How much out of control is the damage that has been done?
Well, in Waikiki, we have actually one of the few places in the Pacific where we have data from the 70s. Albeit that may not have been the most healthy time, but there's nowhere else in the Pacific that has this kind of species by species biomass over time and space.
The data you
we
really need.
We have the data that shows just how much our reef has changed. And so a reef that would have had 85 species of macroalgae like Limokala are now dominated by three invasives, two of which nothing will eat, at least in our current fauna.
Not doing anybody any good.
Correct. And so these are persistent changes that unless we intervene and interrupt those cycles and try to push a different trajectory, we're going to be looking at this potentially spreading, potentially island-wide. And that could be disastrous for people who rely on healthy reefs for food.
What kind of energy needs to be focused here? There's a cleanup coming up this weekend.
And those are wonderful events. It's a heartwarming feeling for, I think, everybody who gets involved, from little kids to the kupuna from the Department of Education's program have come down.
But they tend not to be ongoing.
That's right. We need far more effort. We need new tools, and we have actually some graduate student research that's focused on providing us the information for what our native urchin would actually eat in this assemblage. Kaneohe and Waikiki are different enough in their impact. We can't take Kaneohe data and assume that it will work in Waikiki. We have some really fascinating studies that were done by an undergrad looking at what reef fish that are not in our ocean but should be, what those fish at the aquarium will actually eat when given a choice between a native and an invasive. Mm-hmm. We've found three species of fish in the aquarium that will prefer to eat Gracilaria salicornia.
Native species.
Native species of fish. They're just not on our reefs.
So if they were reintroduced or revitalized?
We could see a sea state change.
And that would be a natural solution that would not pose the risks.
Precisely.
The invasives have
there certainly are risks. There's few of these ecosystems are in balance, but we've got to work within our native species in order to find these solutions. So science has the opportunity to give us the tools that can be the next generation of activities.
But it really needs to be an across-the-board understanding, almost reef by reef, where the work needs to be done.
That's a really important point, Chris, because what I've realized in the last few years is that we can talk about biomass, these piles of algae on the reef, but in order to make it better, we need to consider species-by-species solutions. And I'm not trying to make an infinite job security for me and my students, right? But we really need to know what fish eat which algae grow where, how these factors are all interacting. So in Waikiki, we have a novel advantage because we know where the natives were 25 years ago.
You don't have to worry about your job security because this problem is not going
it's
away.
It's not going away.
Thanks very much for talking
to
us.
My pleasure. And please, everybody come and log in to the Waikiki Aquarium website, waikikiaquarium.org, if you want to join the cleanup. Thanks so much.
Dr. Celia Smith of the UH Manoa Botany Department will take part in the Waikiki Aquarium's next invasive algae cleanup, March 22nd. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Straub Clinic and Hospital, a proud healthcare partner of University of Hawaii Athletics. Learn more at straubhealth.org.
Discover what it means to be Irish.
We're a melting pot of Vikings, Celts, English, Normans, Spanish, French.
Hear why folk music plays such an important role in Ireland.
The music is a lifeline. It was a lifeline to the Irish in the diaspora, because it was the way they stayed connected to home.
Through our songs, we express ourselves as a people.
And get an insider's look at Belfast on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tuesday at 4 p.m. following Fresh Air.
Bethann, we just asked Dr. Celia Smith why none of her students called in with the answer to the backyard quiz.
I thought for sure that was going to happen today.
But the answer was smothering seaweed, and that's, although the term seaweed I don't think is terribly accurate, it still describes what happens when the reef gets killed, because when coral gets killed, everything follows. It just, you know, the death of the reef around the islands is really a sad thing to witness.
And that whole discussion about trying to keep our ecosystem in balance, frankly, could have been applied to any of the conversations that we had today, because we are all really looking at how to create some balance socially, environmentally, any other way that ends in an adverb, L-Y, you can do that too, but how do you find your way there?
And how easy it is to throw a system out of whack with even a well-intentioned introduction.
Well, we'll see what happens with some of the introductions of those bills that we talked about earlier and whether they create a little bit more balance for public housing and affordable housing. We'll continue to watch that, as I'm sure you will too. But that's going to do it for today for us. Tomorrow, remember the generation that fought World War II? Well, they knew they were up against evil and believed it was a cause worth dying for. But what about today's young people? With the spread of allegiance to IS, what's the conversation about destroying that evil? We're going to talk with UH Professor Jairus Grove.
And we'll have a preview of A Slice of Danger, a film noir comedy coming to downtown.
You can call us on our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BecauseHPR.
And you can listen to this show or a past one on hfair2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right back here for more of The Conversation. See you then.